Welcome back to the Punish Podcast, the podcast of punishbacklog.com. I'm Amanda Tien, an editor at the site, and today I'm setting out to answer a big question. What were the best video games of 2024? I love hearing what people love, and plus, I need those answers. I actually didn't play that many games from this year, my life was very hectic, and I need to know what to prioritize in my backlog. Especially as we enter a time of the year where many of us have some much needed downtime, you know, to travel, see family, catch up on chores, side projects, and, you know, opportunities to binge a bunch of video games. To get my answers, I opened up my question to my fellow writers at the Punish Backlog and asked them to sign up for basically a speed dating session with me, where they try to pitch me on one of their favorite games from 2024. I'll ask each one three questions. One, to briefly describe the game to me as if I'd never heard of it before, which is true in some of these examples. Two, what they love most about it, with no spoilers. And three, who might enjoy this game. Like, if you enjoy XYZ kind of game, you'll love this one, that kind of thing. They came back with a great array of games, a range that was reflective of the kinds of quality titles that came out this year. There are massive AAA games, excellent indies, games you've definitely heard of, some you probably have not, you know. They cover, you know, pretty much every genre you can think of. And I'm going to answer my own questions somewhere in the middle. And additionally, at the end, I'll list the honorable mentions, games that people on our site loved but didn't jump on the podcast to talk about. Today, I'm joined by about a dozen writers who are going to talk from 5 to 10 minutes about one of their favorite games that was released this year. So if you've been wondering what are the best video games of 2024, then you're in luck and we will find those answers together. You can listen to this episode all at once, or you can break it up in little pieces. There'll be like a brief musical interlude between each person. And in the caption and show notes, I'll list which games people recommended. So let's get into it and find out what the best games of 2024 were. All right, first up, we've got David Silbert, editor-in-chief, founder of the Punish Backlog. Although I guess then that gets into a whole conversation about editor structure. So we'll just skip that. I'll just say it's just David. I'll include that in there. Let people see behind the curtain. It's fun. So you already heard David there. And David had picked UFO 50, which is by Mossmouth, which is the name for Derek Yu. And then there's a couple other developers also listed on there. John Perry, Maupin, Eric Sergey, and Paul. So tell me about UFO 50. Like, give me a brief description as if I've never heard of it before.
Yeah, so you started with an important piece, which is that it's from Mossmouth, and Derek Yu is probably the most known developer of that. Like, Mossmouth is Derek Yu, right? That's his team, but that's him. And he's known for the Splunky 1 and 2. That's probably what he's most famous for, but he's kind of like known as like very much an indie auteur. Like, people very much respect this man. And he's assembled a small team. And I remember this was important to me at the onset of Punish Backlog. We founded in 2017. In 2018, I distinctly remember writing about UFO 50 after a press release and being very, very intrigued, because the whole premise behind UFO 50 is that Derek and his compatriots, his coworkers, for lack of a better term, were partnering to produce a collection of 50 games, all NES era inspired.
Cool.
That are going to live on the same game, right? So the promise had always been a collection of 50 entirely unique games, all with different mechanics, different designers, different art, different music, and that would all live in one experience. And I remember—
That's awesome.
I'm sure, like anyone else, I was skeptical, but very intrigued. And I think the reason why most of the time you hear something like that, you're like, well, that's shovelware. But knowing the pedigree of Derek Yu and some of the other people, like one of the other developers, I'm not exactly sure who, was the developer of Downwell, which was like a very popular, you might've heard of it. Like, it's like I think it was an iPhone game where it's like an endless runner, but instead of running, you're shooting vertically down as you descend further and further into like some pit of hell or whatever, or dungeon. And that was a very, very addictive game. And so everyone has their own story like that. Everyone's brought some kind of cool game to the fore. And to see like four or five folks working in tandem on 50 games was so cool. Yeah. Anyway, fast forward to 2024, comes out, and lo and behold, it's really, really good. It's really,
Yay!
Really good.
Yay! Yeah. And that's also really cool that it's like part of an editorial origin story for you in some ways, right, too, that you've been following it for so long.
Yeah. Yeah. It's followed kind of the the length in the history of the site itself. So it's about as old as the site is. So I think I was very much looking forward to covering it. And not to jump the shark here, but like...
Go for it. Jump it.
I think it's fitting. I'm giving you a little sneak preview, a little sneak peek. But one of the things I've been doing as I played through these 50 games... Now, I should preface, they're not all home runs, right? I've been working on a piece that hopefully will publish around the time that this goes live, where I've given mini reviews to all 50 games. About 10 minutes ago, I finished, not completed, but at least tried the 50th game.
Nice.
And I've been giving them mini reviews from like 1 star to 5 stars. 5 stars meaning must play. 1 means maybe try it once and then you're done. And I am pleased to say that I would say like 30 of the 50 games are either like 4 or 5 stars. Maybe even more, maybe like 35. There are some clunkers. There are some 3 stars and there are a handful, fewer than 5, that are like 2 or 1 star, thankfully. They're all really good. And I keep bringing myself back to this. I mean, if the game was UFO 20 and it was just the 25 star games that I liked or 4 or 5 star, I would still think it's an incredible game. But the fact that there was 50 games worth of content, I've logged like 80 something hours into it.
Whoa, wow.
Yeah. And I haven't really I've scratched the surface. Like to give you more of an idea of the structure, typically you get rewarded for completing a game. So if you just complete it, you get basically a trophy. But each game has a kind of a completionist run or challenge. And if you complete that, you get the cherry. And so I have about like, I think like 10 cherries or 15 out of the 50. And I've maybe beaten like 15 games, cherried 10 of those 15. And the game now is like, can I complete all 50? Can I get the completionist cherry for all 50? And it's, the games again are they vary in quality and difficulty and genre, but it's like it brings you back to this era of gaming where you never kind of knew what you were going to get. Like it harks back to an era where games were hard. Like you the games were short, but they were hard as hell. So you might never see the end of the game, even if it's only 5 hours long, right? And some of the games in this are actually like 3-4-ish plus hours long. There are puzzle games, there are strategy games, there are shoot 'em ups, there are beat 'em ups, there are full-fledged RPGs. You name the genre, there's like a deck builder game in there. There's an amazing idle, like a cookie clicker-esque game in there.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that's not there, Amanda, and the only reason why as I formulate my thoughts for those quick mini reviews, and I'm planning on doing an actual review, I wish there was like a farming
sim
or something. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. There's Mario inspired games, there's Zelda inspired game, there's Metroid inspired game, Metal Gear Solid inspired games, there's all kinds of point and clicks are in here. There's just so much breadth and depth in this game that as I'm thinking about doing my larger review, honestly, I've contemplated giving it the site's first 10 because I think I think it's well deserved.
It's amazing.
I've decided, having reflected on it, probably not. I think I'm landing on a 9.8.
Yeah, so but still.
That will still be the highest awarded game in the history of the site. Either a 9.8 or a 9.9. And the reason why I shy away from the 10 is just that I don't typically view like a game that gets a 10 as like perfect. And this game is far from perfect. Like some of the games, again, like I think some more work could have been done to like flesh them out. But I also think like, can I recommend it to literally anyone? And you're the person I think about the most. I don't know. Like, there is like a thing where some of the games are like almost borderline frustratingly difficult.
Yeah, and I'm a kind of a quitter.
That's the thing is like, I would argue that it's the kind of game that you might like or that anyone could pick up and play because there's such a breadth and depth.
Yeah.
There's so many games. It's kind of, you're supposed to find ones that you gravitate toward and some that you don't like. I think that's kind of part of the experience is what games do I really, really like? What games do I absolutely hate? And I guarantee you talk to someone else playing this game and they'll have, like, if I'm talking to Donovan, Donovan's going to really like that beat 'em up, Streets of Rage kind of game. I wasn't that big on it, but that's cool. I'm sure some people are going to really like the RPGs. I'm like, everyone has their own thing and it kind of harks back to like what your interests were as a gamer when you grew up in the 80s, 90s, aughts, and I think that's what's like really fun about it. And So a lot of reviewers like Jason Schreier and others have kind of, I think, hit the nail on the head with the assessment. The critique is that this is a collection that they're glad to have. It's like, it's almost like a celebration of gaming's history. And even when it doesn't always hit the mark, it's just such a special thing to be able to experience that I think high marks have to be a given. I don't know if it's quite the like, if I'm just going to recommend a game of this year, it would probably be actually Metaphor ReFantasio, but I'm sticking with my guns, Amanda. I'm saying UFO 50 because it's just amazing. It's so unique. I can't wait for it to drop on Switch.
It sounds like it'll be perfect on
Not
Switch.
Not only that, yeah. I haven't even mentioned the fact that multiple games, many games have multiplayer components. So there's two-player mode.
No way. Amazing that it can
there's
handle
There's a Smash-like
that.
Game. Wow. There's a Mario Kart-inspired game, fun party game. There's so many fun experiences in here. And I just want people to like dig in and realize how much fun is in this game.
I love that. I mean, when I think about what this, the last question of my three was, which is like, who might enjoy this? What I'm hearing is that it might be fun for anybody who enjoys sort of that feeling when you walk into an arcade and you're like, what am I going to play now?
Yeah, that is an excellent way to put it. I would say it's like, exactly. Or it reminds me a little bit of the Orange Box too, where it's like you buy that game. It's a little different because Valve, obviously, none of those games are misses. They're all hitters, but it's only, I think, 5 games there. But it's like, it's just like you buy it and you don't expect to love everything. And that's part of the joy is I think it's fun to find a game that you love and it's fun to find a game you don't like. And that way you can share. It's about the meta game of like sharing stories with your friends or, you know, going over to a friend's house for couch play. And finding a way to get that cherry that your friends struggled with. It's like you kind of like. There's a community aspect to it that's very fun. There's also a whole meta game of like, there's a terminal. You can enter like little like code snippets into it. And it's wild. There's so many layers to it. It just has so much richness under the surface. So I think it's a shame that it's kind of trapped on PC right now. Because
for now,
it'll absolutely come to Switch.
Yeah,
I guarantee you. And my prediction is it will have that kind of Hollow Knight appeal where on PC, people gave it 9s and 10s. But it wasn't until I hit the Switch that it became like an absolute sensation. And I predict that UFO 50 will have that. It will have that day. I just think as I sit back and I kind of enjoy kind of like, you know, again, only scratching the surface, but 80 hours deep. I can't wait for other people to get their hands on it because I think it's going to be something very, very special.
That's so amazing. Oh, I love that. And I think to me, I'm hearing just a lot of that joy and also I think for people who like exploring things, like I'm definitely an explorer and you also, I know, are a completionist. And so the fact that it can give things within that. And I love that idea of being able to talk about like, well, which was your favorite game? You know, the fact that there's 50, I mean, you got to respect that. Well, that's great. I'm going to let you go. And yes, UFO 50 is available on PC right now. David, thank you for sharing. I'm genuinely so excited for
25 bucks too. 25 bucks for 50. So 50 cents a game when you think
about it. Wow. When you talk about the economics of it. Yes. Incredible.
Great value.
Great value. All right, next up, we've got Allison McDaniel.
Hello.
Yay. I'm so excited you're here. And you picked Turnip Boy Robs a Bank, which was developed by Snoozy Kazoo, a LGBTQ studio from Western Mass. Give me a brief description as if I'd never heard of it before.
Yeah, so Turnip Boy Robs a Bank is the sequel to the hit indie Turnip Boy Commits Tax Evasion. However, they are a little different. Robs a Bank is a continuation of the story. It takes place a few days after tax evasion ends.
Escalating the crimes. Yeah.
So they do a genre change up. So the original game was like a top-down 2D Zelda-like game. This is a roguelite. And oh my god, it's so much fun. So you basically go back and forth in and out of the bank trying to gather loot, kill different enemies, and do different fetch quests for your vegetable friends.
Love that. What did you love most about it with no spoilers?
Ooh. So I love the randomness of it. It was my first roguelite and I played it earlier this year and I just kind of loved that it was a bit repetitive in a good way. And yeah, I love randomness in games, and there's a little bit of randomness. I don't want to spoil anything, but that part was awesome.
That was so awesome. That sounds like a good game to binge for a while. Like, just get in the zone, play it over a weekend.
For sure. It's only like 5 hours.
Oh, great.
So you can play it in a sitting or two.
I love that. Who might enjoy this game, in your opinion?
So I think the people who like the story in Turnip Boy Commits Tax Evasion would like this game, because it takes the story and elevates it, and it's funny.
Nice.
And I think anybody who likes pixel art games and like roguelike shooters, I think most people would like it.
So Turnip Boy has a gun? Is that...
He has multiple guns.
Oh, nice! I love that for him.
He does some heinous crimes, but it's all in good nature.
Oh, I love that. That sounds delightful. I'm definitely going to want to binge that over the like long break. This is dope. Anything else that you want to share about Turnip Boy Robs a Bank before we hang up?
So I did review it for the site, and I want to say that it's like the highest reviewed game for the site. I gave it a 9.8 out of 10. So go ahead and read that on punishbacklog.com/turnipboyrobsabankreview and see how you feel about it. And I'm pretty sure it's still on Game Pass. That's how I played it. So it goes on sale every so often on Switch too for like $7-$8.
Ooh,
so
heck yeah.
Worth a try.
Oh,
worth
my God. A try. I love that. Well, thank you for sharing. Turnip Boy Robs a Bank is available on Nintendo Switch, PC, Xbox One, and Xbox Series XS, and Android. Yay, can't wait to play it. I'm going to say that for every game. Can't wait to play it. And I'll mean it too. Next up is Zach Gulinello.
Hello.
And he's going to be talking about very hot commodity game this year, Balatro or Balatro, depending on how you like to say it. I'll be curious on what his opinion on it is. It's by Local Thunk, one-man studio Josh Broadwell. And this game kind of dropped out of nowhere in early 2024. So give us your thoughts. Give me a brief description as if I never heard of it before. Yeah.
Well, first and foremost, I did some research because I was nervous about saying the name. And I read article of an interview with the developers, and they said whatever you want. It was like whatever makes you happy or something. Nice. Like that. So I'd say Balatro, I think. Great. But now I'm overthinking. I don't even know. I'm probably gonna switch it up halfway through, so we'll just roll. I love it. I think it's an amazing piece of art and just a beautiful kind of encapsulation of what makes video games great and fun. And to me, the best part about it is it's shareable and accessible, and it's sort of a poker themed roguelike game, but it gets so deep, yet there's so much to it that's familiar in the poker theme and just card games and all of that, so you can really pitch it to anybody. And I've had so many friends and family members and coworkers bring it up and talk about it, folks obviously on the Punish Backlog, talking about it nonstop all year over the summer. It feels like it's the game that has completely just overtaken everybody's, time and brains. And I think that that's what's so fun about this medium, is it can really, it can become addicting, but also it's just such, fruitful soil, or whatever the phrase, to just talk about things and to have opinions and share and talk and be excited about the same thing. And I think that's awesome.
That's awesome. And I totally agree with your assessment. It just seems like there's so much love and enthusiasm for it. And like amongst gamers that I know and people that are kind of new to it as a hobby. So I know that I played it a bit. Can you try to explain like where it bridges the gap between regular poker and what it is?
It has this basic framework, right? You're given 8 cards, you play your best hand of 5 or fewer, depending. And it feels like any other poker game at first. You're playing full houses, you're playing flushes, you're figuring it out, it's easy, you're collecting chips, you're making money, no big deal. But then I really think the biggest thing to talk about is the Joker cards, which is where everything gets turned upside down. And the amount of Jokers, the creativity among them, there's no way to fully encapsulate or explain what they mean because everyone is so different. And there's easy ones, like you get bonuses for a certain suit or a certain hand type. But then there are just ones that throw everything out the window and give you completely unlimited freedom to kind of craft your deck the way you want. You start to upgrade certain hands. So maybe your full house is actually a better play than your flush, even though, you know, at first they start out pretty similar. You can add different specific cards. You can get rid of cards. There's just the possibilities truly feel endless. And there's so many ways to play and dig in. And there's also countless achievements, decks to get, challenges, ways to figure out kind of your multiplier. Just, you know, I could talk about it for hours.
Oh, I love that. If you had to say, like, what do you think is your most favorite thing about it?
Yeah, I think the reason I would call it a game of the year, I mean, in part, I will admit, you know, I'm a Switch loyalist at this point. So some of the games that are even nominated, I haven't even dug into it. So it's almost by default. But let's not, let that diminish my love for it. I think Balatro is amazing. And the reason that I would put it number one is just because of the accessibility. It's the most quintessential example. You know, my dad plays some video games, you know, from a young age. He would get me into Zeldas and with my brother and stuff. We'd play Secret of Mana. I remember Final Fantasy. We'd play some great games. And he still dabbles here and there, but sometimes it's hard to convince him or, you know, figure out exactly the lane that he's in or the niche that he'd want to kind of poke around in. And I was like, hey, like, I found this game. My friends are playing it. I think you might be into it. And it's like poker, you know, you play card games, all that stuff. You love cards. And it was just the most my dad and probably dad universal, like, oh, yeah, okay, I'll check it out. And I started playing with him. And he's like, I don't really get it. What am I doing? And I was like, no, stick with it. You'll get there. And within a day or two, he was sending me screenshots like, look at my high score.
Awesome.
I just realized you can do this or that or this. And, yeah, you know, my two best friends, Jimmy Amon, give them a shout out here. We've been sending high scores. Jimmy in particular, I mean, the both of them, they're going back and forth. He's sending scores with E's in the middle, the letter E. And it's like, I don't
even, didn't even know that was an option.
I'm telling you, like, that's not, yeah, my numbers usually just stick to numbers, no alphabet in there.
Yeah.
But, you know, all of a sudden my dad's doing the same thing. He's like, look at this. I just reached this ridiculous high score. I didn't even know I could do that. Multipliers on multipliers. And, you know, that's just to not even speak of all the discourse that we've had in our Discord with, on the site, constantly defending or attacking the game. And just the amount of, joy that it's brought, but also the accessibility is the number one thing. It's so easy to just say, hey, to a friend, like, you might like this. And all of a sudden they're obsessed, just without fail.
Yeah.
I think about it at work too. Some guy literally last week on our Slack was like, hey, I heard about this game. Anybody give it a shot? And just like the droves of people that were like, oh my God, are you kidding me? That's awesome. Just started. You're going to be up all night. And sure enough, he checked back the next morning and was like, yeah, you're right. I was up all night.
You know, that's funny because my third question was, you know, who might enjoy this game? And I feel like the answer is similar, like kind of could be anybody or everybody.
Oh, yeah. I think that's the best part. That's really what I love about it. There's so many games, particularly they get nominated, that feel meaty. They're big RPGs. They have kind of the characters in their fantasy land. And I think that can be obviously so great for so many people, but it's not for everybody. And this obviously isn't for everybody either, but I don't know of anyone I've showed it to yet that has been like, ah, this stinks.
It's really digestible. I mean, I think, you know, there's these runs that you'll do, which sometimes can take, you know, depending on how good you are or how bad you are, could take somewhere from like, I don't know, around 20, 30 minutes maybe. And like, you're trying to play different hands, different, you know, trying to get to these different bluffs. And the goal is to, you know, win with the current deck that you're on, and then you can unlock other decks to win other things. Not that I've gotten anywhere close. Like, there's a lot of math and strategy, and like, it's very much a deck building game, but in the like world of poker, and I'm quite bad at it. And I've never won a run. Like, people, like, to your point, there's these different levels. Like, other people on the site were like, oh yeah, I'd love for them to unlock, like, make more decks with different challenges. And I'm like, what? Dude, I'm still on the like starter one. I didn't even know there were other decks. And so I wouldn't say like that I'm good at it or that I necessarily that it's like my favorite game, but I admire it very, very much. Like even without loving it, I'm still like, damn, this is really good. And it's digestible. Like the fact that you could play a hand in for 5 minutes and then put it down and come back to it. I mean, it's accessible.
Totally. And I think that's it's such a high compliment. It maybe doesn't sound like a compliment. It's like when you say the best ability is availability and you're like, eh, good too. But I think that's like, honestly, in gaming and in any medium, just the universal acclaim that something can get. If everybody likes something a little bit, I think that's an achievement. Yeah. As opposed to being polarizing or kind of having one group and not the other. And I think, you know, just like what you said, you can kind of have those situations where maybe you think you're not good or whatever. And I don't really think I'm quote unquote good at it. My two best friends, I was picking their brains and figuring out, you know, am I missing some multipliers here or am I not getting some the right tarot cards or planet cards? What am I missing? And it started to really open up for me. I feel like I kind of triggered some things that just made it more fun. And there's, once you get to that level, I'm not saying you're not or whatever. For me, there's so much there that if you start peeling back those layers of the onion, it just gets better and better.
No, it's so fun. And it's so true that it's like, it becomes a social game in many ways. Well, Bellatro is awesome. And it's available on Nintendo Switch, PlayStation 4 and 5, Xbox One, Xbox Series XS, PC, Mac, and now Android and iOS. So check it out and see what everybody's talking about.
Hell yeah. Give it a shot. You won't regret it.
Next is Vaughn Hunt. Say hi, Vaughn.
Hey, what's up, everybody?
Yay! You picked Tekken 8, which is by Bandai Namco Studios and Erica. So give me a brief description as if I'd never heard of like the Tekken series and certainly Tekken 8.
Yeah, I got you. So, you know, Tekken is probably the second of the biggest 3D fighting games to come out. You know, Virtual Fighter comes out in 1993. Sony's like, oh my gosh, we're releasing a console next year. We need a fighting game that's like Virtual Fighter to compete with Sega. And so they make Tekken in 1994. Both game series share the same creative designer. And yeah, so Tekken 8 specifically, you know, 8th entry in the series. Sony and Namco go way back. And so this is kind of like the start of that partnership with Tekken specifically. So they both turned 30 this year. And so Tekken was turning 30. And they're like, oh, let's put out our 8th game. And so, you know, like most fighting games, the story doesn't really make any sense. So I can tell you, yeah, it's about like this family called the Mishimas, and they have a lot of internal strife between the grandfather, the father, and the son.
Nice, classic.
Someone might transform into a devil. Someone else might transform into a devil. They might fight. The grandfather might be jealous. And that's giving you the Cliff Notes version of what the storyline's about. Family strife and, you know, fighting for a tournament. That is for honor, that is the King of Iron Fist. But in general, you know, Tekken is a fighting game. So, you know, you get a wonderful cast of characters from all different backgrounds. I think one thing they've added to the newer series, I think starting in, I want to say it was 7, all the characters speak in their native languages.
Oh, cool. And you're working on a piece, which I'm excited about, which may have come out already by the time this podcast comes out, but about like the history of Tekken and like 30 years of Tekken. What does Tekken 8 do differently or that's particularly interesting to you?
Yeah, I think with Tekken 8, they've kind of streamlined the series, like each character's fighting moveset down to like almost like a science, I'd say. I wish I could more technically define it, but like each character has like a series of moves that like can be chained together pretty easily now. I think before you had to like learn how to string together combos, and of course like they had preset combos that you could do, but it almost seems like more characters have defined stances. That's the best way to put it. Like having this like rage mode, they call it rage arts now, is what you can do like to like, you know, do extra damage, and everyone has like one of those moves that basically like it's like a super combo. Goes into a little cutscene. But I think having these moves has offset like this rage mode they introduced 2 games ago now. it feels like the game is really balanced again from a competitive standpoint.
Did you play the big Street Fighter game that came out? Was it last year?
Six?
Yeah.
I own Street Fighter 6. I have not.
Oh, okay. Because I'd be curious what your thoughts are between Street Fighter 6 and Tekken 8. But you'll have to report back on that and let me know.
I will.
Yeah. What is something that you love, or what do you love most about Tekken 8 without spoilers? It doesn't sound like the plot is something to be overly concerned about, but still.
Yeah, with no spoilers, I think... You know, the newest character introduced into the series, Reyna, is super interesting. I think she's probably the most exciting character that's been introduced to the series since, obviously, like, I would argue since, like, Tekken 5 with Feng Wei. And the reason she's so exciting is because, like, her moveset's so much fun. She has a close tie to the series that I will not, spoil for anybody.
What's her moveset like?
Her moveset's kind of, she does a martial art called, I want to say it's called Taido. It's a combination of martial arts, but it is like a real martial art. It's like Heihachi combined with like Jun Kazama is the best way to put it. Like, yeah, she's super quick, but she has these like stances that allow her to like make space between her opponent.
Ooh,
and you can't tell when she's making space and when she's like going in for like a kill.
Nice.
And yeah, I mean, Heihachi is also... back. He was supposed to die in the last game, so yeah, that's also something that's interesting about this release.
Classic.
As well. But yeah, I mean, that I don't want to disparage like the other characters that came out in 7. I just think like Reyna is like the most fun.
That's awesome.
And you know, like Leroy is another character that was popular, became a mainline character in the 8th game, so that's also another exciting feature. It's like a DLC character becoming like a mainline character is a big deal.
Congrats to Leroy. yeah. Who might enjoy Tekken 8?
I think anyone who grew up playing like fighting games from that era, right?
Mm.
Soul Calibur is, in hiatus, we'll say. I don't want to say it's gone forever. But we've lost a lot of good series over the years. You know, like, there's no more Bloody Roar, is the one you could transform into, like, monsters and attack people. Virtual Fighter is very much still around. It just hasn't released its latest iteration. But yeah, so I think anyone who's loved fighting games, who's interested in fighting games, my best friend who never played a fighting game saw, like, the good reviews because, it has a 90 on Metacritic.
Yeah, which is nuts to me. Yeah. Like, love that for Tekken, but I was just like, whoa, that's crazy.
It is crazy, but Street Fighter 6 got a 92.
It did, yeah, which we were also, in our fantasy gaming, like, podcast episode series, we were lamenting because Sam drafted Street Fighter last year, but then didn't draft Tekken 8 this year, and then Tekken's done so well, and we're all like, damn, like, we haven't learned our lesson at all.
Listen, fighting games are back as of last year.
We love that for them.
We love that. Yeah, and that's the big thing. People love fighting games. You want to see them come back. Like, that's who Tekken 8 is for.
That's so fun. Well, Tekken 8 is available on PlayStation 5, Xbox Series XS, and PC. All right, next up is Joe Chivers.
Hello, how's it going?
Joe picked Buckshot Roulette, which is made by Estonian solo developer Mike Klubnica, and it was published by Critical Reflex this year. So give me a brief description of Buckshot Roulette as if I'd never heard of it before, which is a fact. I'd never heard of it before you named it.
So imagine, if you will, playing Russian roulette, except this time you're not playing it with a revolver with one bullet loaded. Instead, you're playing it with a shotgun, which, I admit, that sounds like a terrible idea, and it but the core loop of the game is effectively you're playing against this masked weirdo who seems to be maybe not quite human, who loads a sequence of shells into the shotgun that can be either blank or live. You don't know the sequence, nor does he.
Ooh.
So you have to essentially use probability to decide whether you want to take a shot at him across the table or take a shot at yourself. Sometimes it's 50-50. Sometimes it's sort of like there's 8 shells and 2 of them are blank, and it's a lot more risky, I suppose. And then you also, on top of that, have items that you can use that make it that can tip the balance in your favor a little bit, like a magnifying glass that you can use to look at the cartridge in the chamber, a cigarette that you can smoke to get your health back, which, again, not a great idea. beer that you can use to cycle the gun, and a range of other sort of unique items like that. The items are random. So it's a game essentially all about probability, with lethal consequences. And its tone is superb. If you've ever seen the John Wick movies, imagine playing a shotgun roulette against a demon in the basement of the Circle Club from the first John Wick movie, and you basically have Buckshot Roulette, and I love
it. Vibes. Is there sort of like a journey that you're trying to go on? Like, is there a plot more than it? Or tell me about that. It's like,
ostensibly you're doing it for money.
Nice. Also, you know, a John Wick energy.
Yeah, definitely. You essentially come to in a club bathroom and then walk out and go across a balcony into the room where you play the game. So there is not much plot with regard to like who this other person is. You know, it's less like Inscription and more like a flash game almost, you know.
Great game that you could binge for a while too. Like, it's interesting that you brought up Inscription, because that was the first thing I was thinking of too. I was like, masked weirdo across the table who I'm like trying to, you know, do some kind of escape from, some kind of journey playing with cards.
But yeah, it's great. And I will say as well, one extra feature that they've added recently is multiplayer. So,
oh, fun.
I've been playing that with a friend of mine recently, and we have just been, you know, having great fun shooting the hell out of each other and ourselves. So,
what do you love most about it, with no spoilers?
I think you kind of nailed it earlier when you said about vibes. You know, I think that there's this overwhelming sense of threat and sort of like just a slightly grimy energy to it, which I think is probably, if I drew the closest analog to it, it would be Act One of Inscription. You know, there's this sense of like the place you're in is not quite right. The club is, you know, as far as I can tell, unoccupied apart from you and the thing on the other side of the table, and and one guy who's standing on the balcony who you can't interact with. And I've definitely had moments where I was like, oh, maybe if I click on him, I can, like, I don't know, talk to him, or you know, push him over the balcony, which I think right. Been playing Hitman too much, maybe, but
yeah.
that was my thought. But no, you can't. So it is effectively just a game about probability. So I think it appeals to me also in the same way as Balatro. There's that sense of gambling.
That was what I was about to ask. I was thinking, who might enjoy this game? Balatro, you know, it sounds like that would appeal to that. Who else do you think might enjoy Buckshot Roulette?
I think anyone who enjoys roguelikes or roguelikes would like it. You know, there is the ever present threat of consequences looming over you, and you know, if you die, you just restart and that's it. And it's quite a short game; like, it's definitely a full run will only take around 20 minutes, probably. And it just makes it very Moorish in that way that, like, some roguelikes are, you know. So I would definitely recommend it to anyone who likes roguelikes, and anyone who really enjoyed Inscription, or anyone who enjoys the sort of gambling aesthetics of something like Balatro. Yeah.
That's awesome. And I noticed, I was just checking on Steam, it's $2.99 on Steam for PC, that sounds like a great deal for that.
Yeah, definitely. It's, you know, if I can plug my GamesRadar piece that I wrote the other day about this year being a year of cheap masterpieces, I think it's up there for sure. Like, £2.49, and I've played it for, you know, many hours, and I think that's superb value. It was originally an itch.io thing, and, you know, it's definitely got that, like, indie heritage that you would expect from a game that's come from there. But yeah, I would recommend it to anyone who wants to try it. Drop, you know, how much did you say it was in America?
Oh yeah, that's true. I know you said $2.99.
Yeah,
$2.99. Which is a great deal.
Yeah,
less than a latte.
Exactly, well worth a go. You know, you can get your existential horror on for, as you say, less than a cup of coffee.
Although I probably won't, because I'm a huge scaredy cat. But I did see the art, and I thought, looks like awesome vibes. Well, that was perfect. Like we said, Buckshot Roulette is currently available on PC via Steam. next up is me, Amanda. I'm going to interview myself. Fun. First question is, tell me about, I'm supposed to introduce myself. See, this is going off to a great start already. My name is Amanda Tien, and I'm going to be talking about a little indie game called Thank Goodness You're Here. It's by a Yorkshire-based indie studio called Cole Supper. It's a duo, Will Todd and James Carbutt. I'll go ahead and, briefly describe the game to me as if I'd never heard of it before. So Thank Goodness You're Here is a platformer that is unlike any other platformer I've ever played. Like, the only actions are moving, jumping, and slapping people and stuff. It's this like Metroidvania title, which means like you're moving around a map, looking for clues, looking for items that you need to bring back to other people, like doing these little quests, like you have to unlock X, Y, Z before you can do ABC, stuff like that. And the entire time you're playing this young lad, this traveling salesman, who's visiting this little town called Barnsworth. And you have to help like all these random townspeople. You know, it always starts with, you know, him getting roped in this, you know, some kind of ask, and somebody going, "Oh, thank goodness you're here." You know, sorry in advance to Joe and other UK listeners for that British accent. And the game does a really good job of not holding your hand on anything, but it does give you gentle guidance in the direction of things. Like, you might see a man that's got his arm stuck down a, you know, manhole cover, and he's like, "Oh, I need help, blah, 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 blah." And earlier in the game, you've been shown to like a butter shop, and you realize that like the butter might help you get him unstuck. There's another part, for example, when you realize that the only movement is hitting stuff, it's just sort of delightful. You just start hitting everything. Like, you're just like, I'm gonna slap that giant tomato. I'm gonna slap that lamppost. I'm gonna slap that person. Like, you know, and obviously there's hilarious results of everything. Without spoiling anything, one of the things I figured out pretty early on that I could hit with some delight were these like bulging trash bags around town. At a certain point, I run into a garbage man in Barnsworth who is talking about he can't wait to finish picking up trash so he can go home and like do his puzzles. And I'm like, oh no, like I've been hitting all these trash bags. And then at a later point in the game, you see him again and he's like, "Who is doing this? Like, who is releasing all of this trash?" And I'm just like, oh my God. And I don't want to spoil anything, but it all works out in the end. And it was just like the care to do that through line of sort of this background character. And that's something I'll say in general with the game. With Metroidvanias and platformers, it usually requires you to backtrack and like go to areas you've been before. And with a lot of these games, you know, if you've already been there, done that, there's nothing new for you to see or hear or do. And in this game, there's just such care to make this village seem real and that these people are real. Like, even no matter how absolutely absurd it is, there's a realness to it. That when you go back into the butter shop, when you go back into the pub, when you go back into the grocery store, like those people are still talking to each other and they're still saying funny things. And, you know, when you walk by the gardener, he's like saying something funny or like interesting. And I just think that there's like this deep care to the player experience too. Like, they recognize you may have gone back there, and rather than just have nothing happen, they add another joke in there. I laughed out loud a lot playing this game. And it's also very creative artistically. There are some really beautiful shots. You know, it's this like very ugly cartoon world, but like they've done a lot of beautiful framing and shots and very clever movement. There's this an original soundtrack that the two guys, they described as oddly moving. And I would say it's an 100% correct description of the soundtrack. The other great thing is that Matt Berry is a voice actor and he does an amazing job. There's like a full voice cast that does an excellent job. All these like different regional actors. But Matt Berry is really fun. If you like the show What We Do in the Shadows, I think you'll really like this too. How interesting. Tell me about what you loved about the game with no spoilers. Oh, thanks, Amanda. Thanks so much for asking me that great question. So I actually wrote a piece on the site about why it's my game of the year. And here's an excerpt from that piece. Thank Goodness You're Here advocates unapologetically to love what we love. It's an extremely peculiar game and it's proud of itself. we should all be proud of our weirds. It's a love letter to every hometown, to being nice to strangers, to little funny bits and jokes that become lasting memories. Playing Thank Goodness You're Here was absurd. It was also joyful, annoying, emotional, frustrating, gross, it's an M-rated game, and sweet. But this is what life is, isn't it? Living is all the good and bad and weird, all at the same time. In an 1889 essay, Oscar Wilde wrote, "Life imitates art far more than art imitates life." You know, each day we can choose to be kind and neighborly, choose to smile in the face of what life throws at us, and choose to unabashedly love what we love. Therein lies a truth of what I want to carry forward with me from this year, that no matter how tiring and confusing my life has been, I always tried my best to be a helpful person and stay true to my values, and that I laughed along the way. Thank goodness you're here. Thank goodness you're here. Oh, so that was a very nice esoteric message, but like, who might else enjoy this game? Oh, Amanda, that's a really good point. Thank you. So if you're a hardcore gamer that admires indie games that do something different, I think you'll love this. If you vibed with Donut County, Untitled Goose Game, West of Loathing, or The Case of the Golden Idol, I think you'll get a kick out of this game. It's definitely a fun and I think pretty accessible game to figure out. I just think there's like this great tongue-in-cheek affection throughout. If you're looking for a story-driven game, and you like weird things, you know, if you're looking for sort of an experience that's not going to take more than a couple hours, if you're curious about it, it's worth trying. I mean, it's a weird game. I'll say that. It's definitely a weird game, but I think it's a great example of an artistic vision that someone is committed to, and I just really admire that. Great, Amanda. Thanks for joining me on the podcast. Thank Goodness You're Here is available on Nintendo Switch, PlayStation 4, and PlayStation 5, PC, and Mac. Awesome. Yay! Support art! All right, next up is Sam Marinelli, another editor here at the Punish Backlog. Say hi, Sam.
How's it going?
You picked Astrobot by Team Asobi, published by Sony. So give me your thoughts on Astrobot. I know it's one of a couple games for you that could be a Game of the Year contender.
Yeah, so every year, the video game gods bless me with a handful of games, maybe just one game, that feels like it was made for me personally. And this year, that's what Astrobot was. I'm not sure it's my game of the year, but it's like up there because it's so catered towards my personal tastes.
Oh, perfect. Okay, so tell me why you think that is. Like, give me a brief description of Astrobot. I didn't play Astro's Playroom, which was like a demo game, it was like a launch game a couple years back, right, for PS5. So I really had no context for Astrobot until the trailer dropped. So when I say, like, give me a brief description of it as if I've never heard of it, it's basically true. So you can give me what it is and, like, why you think it's catered to you specifically.
Yeah, so it's Astrobot is a 3D platformer. You play a little robot person from outer space who has a whole team of other robot people. Some aliens come and capture the other robot people and take apart your spaceship. By the way, your spaceship is a PlayStation 5. And so you have to go throughout all of these fun, colorful levels and worlds, all populated with other little robot things. Like, there's little robot animals in every level, robot trees, things like
love
that.
Love robots, hell yeah.
It is adorable. And a lot of the robots, most of the robots that you rescue are just, they look like you, but have like little backpacks or something. But a lot of them are references to classic games that have been on PlayStation consoles for years. So the first robots you rescue are it's Ratchet. You literally rescue Ratchet from Ratchet and Clank and Crash Bandicoot. Later on, you go to Kratos from God of War, Nathan Drake from Uncharted. And even like some of the more like random kind of esoteric, because these games probably were popular at one point, but there were some references here. I had no idea what these games were. Like, there's some RPG man from a game called Ark the Lad.
Oh, yeah. What do you mean? You don't know Ark the Lad? That's classic. Yeah.
but it's
my favorite game.
Yeah. Like, and as you progress through the game, like, you have all these, you get the power ups for certain levels that allow you to engage differently with what's around you. Like, things that allow you to have a go-go gadget arm and grab things from far away, or suck up like green goo and create platforms in the air. It's a terrific platformer. That's as good a description I can give to you. A shorter description is it's if Sony made a Mario Galaxy game.
Oh, cool. There you go.
Yeah.
What did you love the most about it with no spoilers?
So I'm writing about this in my Game of the Year tier list, which I guess by the time that this podcast is out, you certainly will have already read. But
it's a great list. Everybody, if you don't read it already, it's awesome. Yeah, it's Sam ranks every game that he's played from the year.
Yeah, it's definitely finished too. it's a very tactile game. And what I mean by that is it makes full use of the PlayStation 5 DualSense controller.
Oh.
You are, like, for those of you who may not have used a DualSense, it has a really incredible rumble system that differentiates between whether or not you're walking, wading through water or walking through grass or...
Oh, neat.
Yeah, and so it's a game where everything you're doing and hitting and touching and playing with, it's... You feel that in the controller and you feel that in the gameplay at all times. So even like when you start levels, you're on top of a PlayStation 5 controller, little spaceship thing, and you have to hold the triggers to go faster. And because it has that haptic feedback, there's a little more, you have to press it extra hard. It's just a lot of stuff like that. The game is always making use of that controller and always making you, because of that, challenging you to look everywhere in every level for extra, whether it's for extra bots to rescue or extra collectibles or more coins and other things like that. So you're just constantly interacting with everything in the game and you feel every part of that every step of the way. And I think you and I both talk all the time about how much we love the Nintendo DS. And I'm still to this day a big defender of the Nintendo Wii. And I like when game companies have the money and have we're willing to take the risks to not just innovate in new playstyles, but reimagine familiar playstyles. And I think Astrobot does such a good job of that.
Oh, that sounds so fun and delightful. Who else do you think might enjoy Astrobot?
So I would say this is the most Nintendo game that Nintendo has not made. So if you're a big fan of Mario games and Kirby and Sonic, like all these kinds of, I guess Sonic's not Nintendo, but you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
that vibe, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I grew up playing games like that. I grew up playing platformers, 2D and 3D. And so if you're like me and you grew up playing games like that, you will always want games like that. Mm. And Astrobot is just such a refined and well-executed and creative way of doing that. It doesn't reinvent the wheel in all these ways, but like I said, using that controller, like feeling all of these things and being challenged in all these ways, it really makes a difference. And I think it's really cool. And also, if you're just a big PlayStation person, like these references are cool. I don't want to spoil too much, but like at the end of every world, there's one level that's themed after a particular game.
Oh, that's cool.
And so you're kind of playing a miniature version of that. I'll give an example for the first world, just because it's the first world.
Yeah.
Like you basically just play Ape Escape.
Oh, and, wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, you get the net and like the other bots are the little apes and like you're basically just playing a miniature version of Ape Escape. And so if that matters to you, and based on how much these PlayStation units sell every year and how much these games sell all the time, it does matter to people whether you're really into the PS4 era, you know, Ghost of Tsushima, Horizon Zero Dawn kind of games, or if you like the classic PS2, if your favorite games are Devil May Cry and Metal Gear Solid 2, things like that. You know, they have that too. They have those elements in the game as well.
That's awesome. You know, in many ways, that actually reminds me of Kingdom Hearts, in a kind of vibe of like, I'm going to this different planet. Now it's themed after this other thing. Is there a Kingdom Hearts planet? That'd probably be a nightmare to get through.
There's like, no, I don't think there's any Square.
Your permissions, yeah.
No, they get a lot of third parties, but they didn't get Square for some reason. That's so fair, no Final Fantasy.
Well, Square in there plus Disney. That's all right. Is there anything else that you want to share about Astrobot or like reflecting on why you were excited to talk about it today versus maybe one of the other ones?
I think what really sticks with me with Astrobot is that it's just a constant joy to experience. And not every platformer is like that. Like, there aren't moments of, I mean, some people might disagree with that, on this, but like, there aren't moments of great frustration with Astrobot. It's like, anything that's challenging, you know how to get through it, and it just is a matter of execution. There are plenty of challenge levels, plenty of levels where you're gonna die a bunch of times, and you're gonna, you know, be racking your brain about how can I execute this. But it, I don't know, everything just works in tandem to create a beautiful experience at all times. And it's not just the nostalgia of it. And like, as much as I have an appreciation for all these old games, I sometimes think games that run on nostalgia go too far.
Yeah.
And there's too much leaning on that. I think this game finds a nice balance where there's, it's fun to find Leon Kennedy from Resident Evil 2, but it's not like, here's, we're going to be like overly reverent for all of this. It's just, hey, it's now in your crew of people in your hub world, you can see Leon Kennedy from Resident Evil 2. Like, awesome. And he's playing around with everybody else. Like, it's fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just a game that's constantly fun. It's a game where you, like I write about a lot of games. Some of my favorite games of all time are games that can only be experienced as a video game. Not an interactive movie, not an interactive book, nothing like that. It's, you have to hold the controller and like feel the game and actually play through it to really understand it. And I think that's actually more, it's less common than I think it should be. But Astrobot is a great reminder that there's still more to do.
Astrobot is available on PlayStation 5. Sam, thank you for sharing. And I'm excited to read your tier list, although by the time this comes out, I'll have already read it. And wow, it was such a good piece of writing. Well done. Next up is Alexia Dahlin.
Hi.
You picked Core Keeper, which is made by Pugstorm, a studio based in Sweden. And give me a brief description of it, as if I've never heard of it before.
Core Keeper is like a top-down pixelated game that's kind of a mix between Valheim. Well, I say Valheim first because I like Valheim the most, but it's a mix between like Terraria, Stardew Valley, and Valheim. I think those were like some of the main. I said Terraria, right? Yeah. Those were some of the main inspirations for the devs, and they say that a lot. There's even like little like callbacks to those games in Core Keeper, and it has a lot of like the main storyline is that you're like an adventurer who has been pulled into this underground area by a core, and the core is making you do this stuff to protect it and bring it back to life. Ooh. Basically. And I mean, it's not super narratively strong. The narrative doesn't really show up very much throughout the game, in my opinion. But it is a really fun hook, a little bit different than the other.
You mean like the classic Stardew Valley? My grandpa died.
My grandpa died. Farm. I hit the house. Yeah. So I think that was really also interesting to me. But I mostly like this game because it has all of these cozy elements that I really like from these other games that I also love. But it also has some action. Like, there's some bosses that are a little bit difficult, especially if you play by yourself. Mm. And there's also like difficulty levels. So I think it was a good game to play like by myself, but that also I could play with my partner who likes more like, he's like more of a serious gamer, like some
capital G games. Like,
yeah. Elden Ring.
yeah. I have to have some fights in order for this to work. What are some of the things about Core Keeper that you think make it different and like stand out than, like, they've got the cozy elements, but like, what does it do with those cozy elements that makes it even more different than, let's say, a Stardew Valley?
I really like their progression system, their like skill tree system.
Oh, cool.
It's like skill a point tree. System, which is not super unique, but I thought it was really fun that you could put your points into certain categories like you do in other games that are not Stardew Valley. Like many games, like Stardew Valley has that a little bit with like You have to choose where
you can hear perks, but it's not the same. Yeah,
it's not the same. It's and also you can reset them throughout the game. Like
really nice. Easily. I boofed it once on Stardew and I picked like the worst fishing like perk ever, and I've just like thought about it ever since, being like, oh, that would make no sense. Oh, so sorry, keep talking.
You can redo it.
Okay, good. Eventually, yeah.
I'm such eventually a in a long time, but on Core Keeper it's a lot easier.
Nice,
but I really like it because it's fun for everyone who is playing. Also, like, for there's something for everyone, I feel like, in Core Keeper. That's why I think that it's like one of the better releases this year that I've played. I haven't played a lot of really new games this year because I've been kind of going through my backlog this year since it's been a very busy year for me.
Yeah,
but this is one of the newer games that I've been playing this year that has been like, I play it very often now.
Oh, that's so nice. That's a game that's a regular part of your life. I love that.
Yeah.
What do you love most about it, with no spoilers?
I think I love being able to build in it, because I think that for example, in Stardew Valley, you can't really build. Like, it's just you buy these upgrades.
Yeah.
You can organize your farm, but it's not really the same. And I think that, like, in Terraria, you can build, but it's 2D, so it's not as interactive or cool. And in Valheim, you can build, but sometimes the building in Valheim is a little bit annoying. I think that the building in Core Keeper, even though it's also, like, top-down, it feels, like, a lot nicer for some reason.
Mm.
And it's very interactive. You can decorate everything. You can, like, customize stuff. It's very cute.
Ooh, I like that a lot.
My favorite part.
Yeah. I love it when it's cute. Like, make it cute.
Yeah.
Have you beat the game?
No, not yet.
Okay, yeah. Okay, but that's good, though. It's not, I mean, beating a game like Stardew, or I used to play Harvest Moon games, which we've talked about, I think, on the Stardew Valley Punished chat piece. I had never, I don't know, a lot of those games, you like, the point is not to beat them, right? The point is to like be there in the world and like do the activities. But the core sounded very dramatic, so I was curious if there were.
Oh yeah, I'm actually really excited to like see the next story progression, even though there's like not a lot of story. You kind of just get new perks when you beat each boss.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a few like what is it called, bosses that you don't have to beat but you can if you want. Mm-hmm. To and I've beat a couple of those, but like I don't know why, but I feel like whenever I play a game, I never really want to beat the boss, like,
because then it's over. Yeah.
Even with Skyrim, I play Skyrim so much. I have hundreds of hours in Skyrim, and I only just beat the boss like last year.
Oh my gosh.
Well, not the boss, but like the main quest line.
I get very distracted. I'll go and do literally anything else. Yeah.
Every side quest. Yeah.
That must have been a very exciting emotional moment for you, of like, I finished Skyrim.
It was. I felt like, oh my god, now I have to go finish every side quest, because I finished
everything. And you're like, what else am I going to do with my life?
Yeah, definitely.
Who else might enjoy Core Keeper?
I think that Core Keeper is, like I said, great for people who like more intense games, but who want to play with their partner who likes like less like stressful games.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's also really good for people who enjoy a challenge, but who also really appreciate those cozy aspects of like Stardew Valley and farming sims. I don't think that it would be good for people who really enjoy the socialization aspect of farming sims, because there's no really interactable NPCs. There are like merchants, but you can't talk to them really. Oh, at least at this point in the game.
That's so interesting that it's like not a talkable characters.
No. Yeah, it's like in Valheim where you meet the merchants after you explore. And then you can't really have a conversation with them. They're just there to provide you the materials for that mechanism that they serve. Yeah, so it's not really a social game.
It's like, you just stay there, over there, and do my job for me. Like,
yeah, basically. I'll make you a house, but that's it.
But yeah, I like, Alexia, with Core Keeper, what you're really saying is that the story then becomes what you build out, you know, your own narrative in many ways, and like with your partner and whoever you might play with.
Yeah, definitely.
Core Keeper is available on PC, PlayStation 4, PlayStation 5, Xbox One, Xbox Series XS, and Nintendo Switch. right, next up is Kay Asobi. Kay, say hi.
Hello, hello.
Yay.
It's me.
It's you. And actually, it's great that it's us because you picked Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, developed and published by Square Enix. And we, Kay and I had actually done a chat a couple of years back about Final Fantasy VII Remake. And then there is also a lost to the editing world, probably episode of this podcast, just talking about Final Fantasy VII Rebirth for like 3 hours with David. So even though I clearly already know it, give me a brief description of Final Fantasy VII Rebirth as if I'd never heard of it before.
Yeah, so Final Fantasy VII Rebirth is the second game in the Final Fantasy VII, we'll call it re-trilogy. Obviously, Final Fantasy VII is sort of one of the iconic games in the history of gaming, released in 1997. And then in 2020, long gestating remake rumors finally coalesced in Final Fantasy VII Remake in 2020 and now Rebirth in 2024. Rebirth is a functional open world, story-driven action RPG that is anywhere between 40 to, let's say, 200 hours long.
It's action, it's active combat, lots of drama, lots of characters talking together and building relationships. What did you love most about Final Fantasy VII Rebirth? No spoilers.
So I think the best thing about Rebirth is that the core gameplay, which is the fighting things, is really, really sharp. It's so really, really fun. Good and really, really tight. It really manages to hit this like really perfect blend of managing to retain the turn-based elements when you need it, but mostly functioning very well as like a loose action combat game with the ability to swap between teammates, which I think is a really, really important part of it feeling like a Final Fantasy game to a lot of people. I think obviously Final Fantasy mainline titles tend to explore a lot with their gameplay, and I think 16 was a direction that was like a little bit too solo, a little bit too sort of like Devil May Cry-ish in its gameplay, and then Rebirth kind of pulls it back to this more team focus, going into turn-based time slowdown menus where you can. I like to talk a lot about games are either menus or parkour, and Rebirth is the best of both worlds. Yes. It's parkour and menus. And so I think that is a really important part of the experience, because I think compared to some games I've played, like Persona 5, for example, like in that game, the combat becomes a grind. And I think Rebirth never really hits that point, just because they have improved upon it from Remake in so many ways. And they have introduced a lot of characters that each have their very fun, specific like niche and gimmick that makes all of them like really fun to play. For example, like I played the second time through on hard mode, and I pretty much like just played as Tifa. And like that sort of like, you know, gameplay expression is totally possible, and I think they just did a really good job of nailing it. Obviously the story, you know, the content is sort of overwhelming. The story is, you know, it's melodramatic JRPG fare, so whether that really hits that right note with you or not is, I think, certainly a you know, sort of variable, but I just think the combat is really what makes the meat of this game really good. And I do think, for what it's worth, it's a very sincere game. Yes, in every respect.
100%. I mean, and the combat is amazing. Like when you play, like, and you land combos or you're moving around, like you feel like you're amazing. Like I feel like I'm Cloud with the Buster Sword. I'm like, I'm killing this, or I'm Aerith, and I'm like landing the spells, landing the different wards that are going around with Tifa. She's so fast, and you know, she gets up close. I mean, and they all are just like really delightful to play. I mean, I think about Baldur's Gate 3, which I played shortly before Rebirth, and I loved Baldur's Gate 3, but I think you totally nailed it, that Rebirth does a great job of making it feel really active, and that you're still clever in the menus. Like when you land like your menu combos, you're like, oh, I'm so smart.
Like, yeah, it just hits all the right balances, I think, of like positioning mattering, execution mattering, but not so punishingly so that like you're locked out of the game because you can't perfect parry.
Yeah.
Or, you know,
which I cannot, by the way. I don't think I parried once in the whole game.
Yeah. And there are also people who are like really, really mostly playing the game through the menus. And I think that's totally fine. Yeah. I think the fact that it's open to that sort of flexibility is one of the great things about the game. So
totally. And it has a very generous amount of difficulty modes, which make it where you can kind of play just the story. And the music in Final Fantasy VII Rebirth is so good. Like, we were talking about this a little bit in the Discord, and I wrote a short piece about the Gungaga section in particular. But yeah, what do you feel as a fan of the Final Fantasy series? How do you feel about the music in this game?
Yeah, the music is pretty incredible. It has almost like a Smash Bros-esque vibe, where there are so many remixes and like unique versions of like individual themes. I believe that the way they do the boss battles is like, there's like every boss has like a unique rendition of Seven's like boss battle theme, for example. And there's some of them are just incredible. Like when you fight like Roche in chapter 3 and it pulls out the full like, you know, big band jazz version of his theme and stuff, like there's some great new pieces, and there are some really fantastic remixes that are just peppered throughout the game, and you hear them for like 1 minute, and then they like, there's one scene later in the game where you have a boss battle, and then you get a very sort of fourth wall breaking like, rest here, you have another fight coming up moment, and then like the resting battle music in that like one scene is incredible. Yes. And it's just like, it doesn't play anywhere else. Like, there's a lot of gems like that in this game that I think are just, it really goes to show how much like kind of care and love and dedication is to this project. And it's especially interesting because, you know, Kitase, Nomura, Nojima, like all, a lot of the old heads are also involved with this project, so it's just very interesting to see how they've kind of like kept that legacy going and are still tied into the project at large
and doing something amazing with it. Excited for part 3 of the whenever it comes. Might be a while, but I'll be ready.
I think 2027, 30th anniversary, that's my guess, but maybe that would be a little too nice.
Who else might enjoy Final Fantasy VII Rebirth?
I think if you played Final Fantasy VII, you might or might not enjoy this game. If you played Final Fantasy VII Remake, you might or might not enjoy this game. Sorry.
It's true, though. No.
I do think you can go into playing this game without playing the original. I think that is sort of maybe in some ways the intended meta narrative viewpoint from which to approach this game. I think if you are very heavily indexing on certain things that happen in Remake, you may not enjoy this game as much. But for the most part, I would feel pretty good about recommending this game to anyone who is capable of tolerating JRPG melodrama.
There's definitely some extremely melodramatic moments, but on the upside of that, there's some like really nice, like, I don't know, the sincerity, there's this wistfulness, there's like a romanticism to it that's really nice to see and kind of interact with. I really enjoyed it.
There's a moment that was like 27 years in the making for me that I was like, this is the peak of my year. Like, nothing will ever top this. So, look forward to that sort of thing.
I love that. After we hang up the call, I am going to ask you what it is because I'm very, very curious. But Final Fantasy VII Rebirth is very fun, very beautiful, at least in both of our opinions. And it's exclusively available right now on PlayStation 5. A little postscript here. We recorded Kay's session during the Game Awards. At the Game Awards, they announced that Final Fantasy VII Rebirth would be coming to PC on January 23rd, 2025. So you'll get check that out. And also, Final Fantasy VII Rebirth did win the prize for best score and music, which is awesome and super well deserved. Next up is Gary Wilson. Hi, Gary.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good. I'm excited to chat. I'm really excited to chat about this game because Gary picked Metaphor ReFantasio, which is many people's top, you know, game of the year type pick. We're actually recording this in the middle of the Game Awards. So for all I know, they're about to win like while we're talking. But Metaphor was developed by Studio Zero and published by Atlus and Sega. They've made a lot of the Persona games. So give me a brief description as if I never heard of this before.
Certainly. So Metaphor ReFantasio, Fantasio, you know, whichever way they decide to go with this, you know, it is the new Persona-esque JRPG from the Persona team. It's still got everything that you would imagine from a Persona game, from social links under a slightly different name to dungeon-based combat, you know, turn-based with a variety of different magic spells versus physical attacks and things like that. But instead of being set with teenagers in a high school setting with teenage problems, it is instead a high fantasy world built around the kind of trials and tribulations of one hero as he attempts to take the throne after the previous king has been assassinated. So you are gathering a party of different tribes of individuals. The world is populated by different tribes that have, you know, different characteristics, all of them at least vaguely humanoid. There is one tribe that we really kind of stretch that humanoid to the extents. But you're gathering a team, you know, coming from all those different tribes to get different perspectives on the world as you're attempting to take what you feel is your rightful place upon that throne.
Ooh, that's a very intense plot.
Yes. when it was first described to me, you know, when it was first announced a couple of years ago, I really didn't know what to make of it, you know, especially coming from a team that is so built around, you know, not realism.
Who am I going to go on a date with? Yeah. I'm late for homework.
Right. Like, no one's going to sit here and say that, you know, the Persona worlds are realistic, but at the very least, you do have to take a bike to school.
You have to take a bike to school and then to the dungeon to fight bad guys. Like,
right. And so now it's, you know, you have to take a runner, which is a vehicle with legs that literally runs across the ground to go from town to town to then stand on a dais and tell the people why you are the best candidate.
Oh my gosh. Oh, this is very interesting and like a very different, that sort of reminds me in many ways of Fire Emblem Three Houses, which like at first it's like Hogwartsy school type activities. And then all of a sudden it's like, whoa, this is a like multi-generational war and there are dragon people. Like this is also about power in a way I wasn't expecting.
Yeah. So, you know, the thing about metaphor that a lot of people are going to talk about is people are going to use that kind of persona Q word, because especially here in the West, you know, Persona is the big series from Studio Zero, from Atlas, you know, it's the one people know. I would say in story, less in tone, but definitely in story and kind of presentation, this is way closer to the proper Shin Megami Tensei's, you know, Devil Summoner, Nocturne, things like that, with a little bit more, you know, let's call it grit.
Yeah. What did you love most about this game with no spoilers?
Yeah. So with no spoilers, I would kind of say it in two folds. What really jumped out to me. One, I really think this is the most refined version of the Studio Zero combat that we have seen so far. Cool. You know, they definitely took the things that worked out of Persona 5 Royale, you know, really kind of took those things and really streamlined it out into a way that actually really kind of makes sense and kind of fits with what we're expecting these days in an RPG. You know, the biggest way that comes out is in the summon system. You know, Persona has your personas. You know, you can spend hours in the menu fusing personas together to try to get the one with the right stats. I say that as if I'm not the person who has done that exact thing. Gone is that. Now it's all based around archetypes, and archetypes have a set number of stats and a set number of skills that you have to unlock in different ways. Each character can take any archetype. So no longer do you have to deal with, you know, Yukiko in Persona 4 being exclusively the fire healing mage. Oh, you know, now you can take that character and be like, you know what, for this dungeon, you're going to be the assassin that stabs people in the back, or you're going to be the big tank with the big shield. And there is that level of flexibility, but also the streamlining into, you know, you have these set number of choices. You can't sit here for an hour and try and make the best boss. Like,
yeah,
you're stuck with it. The other part I think that really jumped out to me as to what I loved was that getting away from that real world setting really allowed the team to kind of expand its wings and show what they can do on a storytelling part of things. You know, by keeping it, again, no one is going to sit here and say that a Persona game is realistic, but by having it not be in Tokyo or, you know, fake Japanese town in the fields, you know, by being able to say we can do anything with this world and make it whatever we want it to be, it really allowed them to kind of play into those corners, play into more weird things, play into strife that I don't think they would ever really be comfortable talking about. You know, one of the best parts about setting up this kind of tribal system I mentioned before is we get to talk really abruptly about racism, which especially in Japan is a hard thing to talk about because it means something really different in Japan than it would here in the West. But because it's kind of removed from what the Japanese would perceive as racism versus what the West would perceive as racism. You could actually talk about those things in a little bit more blunt language that is understood without having to do the nuance up front.
That's awesome. And it sounds like it's hitting those marks in a way that the last mainline Final Fantasy didn't, right? Like, I feel like some people were frustrated by that.
Yeah, you know, this is not a Final Fantasy 15. Yeah. You know, this is not a Final Fantasy 16 conversation, I would say those are two very good examples of, you know, things that attempted to make that swing to talk about, you know, caste systems and class structures and things like that, and kind of whiffed it a little bit.
Well, it's nice to know that metaphor crushes it. Or who else might enjoy this game?
I would say that the sweet spot of someone to enjoy metaphor are people who are really interested in a traditional RPG. You know, this is still a traditional turn-based RPG to a certain extent. You know, I play a lot of RPGs. I am someone who will just play a lot of them. And especially this year, there has been more traditional RPGs that allow you to do in-field combat as well. Mm. Weirdly enough, there were three of them this year before being very few previous.
Clearly there's something in the water. People are figuring it out.
Caveat, one of those games, Trails Through Daybreak, actually came out, you know, 3 years ago.
That's true. So they knew it. And you've been repping them for a while.
I have. But
you wrote a great piece on the site if you want to read it.
Yeah. It's a Trails series. Yeah. I could be sitting here talking about that.
Exactly.
The same level of passion. But, you know, this is still traditional. It's still menus. It's still skills that have, you know, enemy weaknesses. This is still, you know, this enemy might reflect physical. It might, you know, be only immune to physical, so you have to hit it with magic. All those things that you would expect are still there, but because it's kind of distilled out and streamlined out and also given flexibility, players who want to try these things without feeling like they have to get it right, you know, that there is an optimal team and you have to do the optimal team or else you're not going to have a good time, that's gone. There is so much more flexibility. There's so much more adaptability that people who've been turned away from the genre in that kind of rigid nature are going to find a lot more fluidity to it.
Oh my God, that sounds awesome. It sounds like there's so much freedom in that. And that's really what you're describing is a lot of what has made me shy away from the genre in general. So I bought it. I can see it wrapped up in my plastic shrink wrap right now. I'm gonna play it.
I will also say, like, weirdly enough, one of the best things that Metaphor has going for it, the time to play is way shorter. Mm. It is still a 50, 60, even 70-hour game if you really kind of get stuck in there. But gone is the 120, 150 hours of Persona 5.
Yeah, I know people for years have been like, I think you'd love Persona 5. I'm like, do you? Like, I don't like following rules. When I get burned out really quickly, like, you're asking me to play a 150-hour game? Like, I don't know if that's me.
Now, again, I can't say anything. In the past 4 years, I have played the entire Trails series, which clocks in across 7 games at about 420 hours of games. So I can't say anything.
Yeah, but right.
What I will say is that this is way easier to deal with on that way. And especially because there's story momentum in, again, Persona 5 Royale. I love it. It's a fantastic game. It lags at certain points, you know, especially as you're going from party member to party member and going through dungeon to dungeon. It can get a little rote. Yes. This has momentum for a really long time.
Oh, nice.
You know, I would say that the rubber hits the road moment actually happens at the end of the free demo that players can pick up.
No way. Well, that's a great compliment. Yeah. Oh my God. Well, that sounds fantastic. We can check out the free demo. Or if you're like me and you already bought it, now it just means I got to plug that disc in. This game is available on PlayStation 5, Xbox Series XS, and PC. Is Ben Roshkovich, and you can say hi, Ben.
Hi, Ben.
Hi. Oh, he's so funny. And Ben picked Prince of Persia, The Lost Crown by Ubisoft Montpelier. But I know that you said it wouldn't be just Prince of Persia on our speed date.
That's right. I've been cheating on Prince of Persia with Stardew Valley, the 1.6 update brought to you on the Nintendo Switch.
Oh, yes, exactly. So we'll get, this will be sort of like a combo little bonus up then. But give me a brief, let's start with Prince of Persia. Give me a brief description of it as if I'd never heard of it before.
Oh, wow. So this Prince of Persia game is a sort of 2.5D side-scrolling Metroidvania. Can I assume you know what a Metroidvania is?
Yes, for the purposes of the okay. podcast, yes. And if you don't, you should look up a list I wrote on the site that explains Metroidvanias. But until then, Ben will keep explaining it. Yeah.
Nice plug.
Nice plug. Gotta plug. Remember, it's a blog that we write stuff.
So it's basically a Metroidvania. It's very combat focused as well. I would say one of the most combat focused Metroidvanias I've ever played.
Cool.
And it also, if you don't know, the Prince of Persia series is kind of like time based, like mechanics and powers. So there's a bunch of those woven into the story and the character's abilities as well.
Nice. I love time stuff. What did you love most about it with no spoilers?
I think the combat and like movement is both that they're very tight and they're also pretty unique for a Metroidvania. I've played a bunch of Metroidvanias. Some of my favorite games are Metroidvanias. and one of my favorite games is Hollow Knight. Mm-hmm. And I would say Hollow Knight has some of the best movement of any game.
Yeah.
And combat, and I think Prince of Persia surprised me because it really gets up there, even though it feels totally different. It's very intelligently designed. I was just consistently impressed by it.
What does the movement feel like? I mean, Hollow Knight, that's a great comparison. Like, Hollow Knight, I feel like, is a very vertical kind of combat game, and you're blurping around. That's the only way I can describe being the little knight. What does Prince of Persia feel like in comparison?
Yeah, so Prince of Persia is a little bit floatier. I think to moving around and also to a degree combat feels a little bit more like Super Smash Brothers.
Oh, fun.
There's a lot more, like, gravity is less punishing, and you also have a much wider kit of abilities and tools to get around. So it's not just like, how do jump. I go past this? No. Yeah, it's not just jump.
Jump less bad. Which is me in most video games. I'm like really bad at jumping. Like, I never time it right. Why does the game
keep telling you to jump less bad?
I know.
Bad.
I was like, I don't want to jump. I was like, I don't
want. You must love Celeste.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, it's very puzzly. Like, Hollow Knight's platforming was sort of puzzly, but it was extremely twitchy platforming and precise.
Yeah.
Prince of Persia is precise too, but it's more forgiving and it's also much more flexible.
Nice.
It almost feels like Breath of the Wild or Tears of the Kingdom-y in terms of the approach it brings to movement philosophy.
Oh, awesome. I like that. Who else might enjoy this game?
I mean, I think if you enjoy Metroidvanias, you should play, because I've been talking a lot about the movement and to a lesser degree the combat, but just the structure of the game is really fantastic. And I think it's one of the best Metroidvanias to come out in a while. I think fans of the Prince of Persia series would like it, just because it's been a minute and it's like a real new installment. And probably just fans of platforming games generally. Like, I think the combat is fun, but if you're not usually a big combat person, it's easy enough to work around.
Well, I like that. Now we can talk about your true love, maybe. tell me a little bit about, you've just been vibing a lot on the Stardew Valley 1.6 update on the Switch. Like, I haven't gotten into it yet. So just tell me your thoughts.
Yeah. So for those who don't know, Stardew Valley is this game that came out, I don't know, what, 20?
A while ago now, yeah.
Yeah. It was made by, for a while, made by a single person named Eric Barone, who goes by Concerned Ape. and it was published or distributed by Chucklefish, I believe. This is just off the top of my head.
Yeah, amazing recall. Yeah.
But I played it a while ago. That was when I was just starting law school. I played it on the PC. That was early days. Like, there was like one farm, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it's gone through a bunch of updates since then. And so the 1.6 update just rolled out, where it was initially going to be just a small update with some quality of life changes and some like end of game updates. But Concerned Ape just sort of went crazy and like worked on it for a long time. There's a deluge of all this new stuff, all this new content, lots of end game stuff. And so, yeah, I'm just diving right back in. It's been a real blast. I'm completely addicted.
It's so good. And it's such a fun game to play on the Switch, too. Like, it's perfect on that. Like, we had another, if you enjoy Stardew Valley content, speaking of which, read our Punished chat about Stardew Valley and, like, why it's so fun on the site. But what do you think you love most about the 1.6 update that you're just so pleased with?
Should we say what Stardew Valley is? I realize I just
started. Oh, it's like, it's a farming simulator. I think a lot I think a lot of people probably know it by now. It is a farming simulator game with sort of pixel art inspired by an old series of games called Harvest Moon. And you run a farm. That's the gist of it. And like, get to know townspeople. So yeah, what do you love the most about the 1.6 update?
So it's kind of interesting. I know some stuff that's 1.6 specific, but because I have not played since like 1.2 or 3, there's a bunch of content that's just new to me baseline. But I do know a couple of things that are new that are really fun are like the new bookseller.
A bookseller?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Nice. And just magic books generally. It's like a new subsystem where you can find and read these books that give you sometimes skill upgrades or sometimes just entirely new powers, which is really fun.
Did you start a new farm?
I started a new farm. This is actually the first time I played on Switch.
Oh, then no wonder you're deep on it. It's so fun. It feels so good. Yeah.
Oh yeah. First time I played was PC, so I was just like it's hard to be as
it's not
playing.
That's how I played it too originally. When it first came out, I played on my computer, and then my family, my mom and my sister, got into it, and they were like, it's so good on Switch. And I was like, it's cool, I played it a while ago, it's not a big deal. And then I went through a phase where I finally got on Switch so I could like do multiplayer with them, which we still haven't done yet, but that's me committing right now that we like want to do it as a resolution for 2025. But I was just like, this is so perfect, and I'm so comfortable in the music, and you're just like blah blah blah, and the controls are it's much easier to binge it for a really long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, well said.
Those are two great games to binge. Prince of Persia Lost Crown is available on, I wrote it down, Nintendo Switch, PlayStation 4, PlayStation 5, Xbox One, Xbox Series XS, Windows, and Mac. And Stardew Valley, I think, is out on pretty much everything now. So, and that 1.6 update is now out on consoles. So
I'm not sure if 1.6 was pushed to mobile yet, but if not, it will be soon.
Nice. Perfect. Good correction. The fun. Did you drink the mayonnaise? Have you drank mayonnaise yet?
No, that's disgusting. But you can, right?
You is can. That well, that's yeah. what I, that's. You can do that in this update. You can drink mayonnaise for like super energy. But like, that's the question. Really? Yeah. Like, yeah. As if you will. Yeah. Apparently, it's.
I won't.
Yeah. As a policy.
Why would I?
I don't know how to live life.
I'm doing a cheese only run.
Dairy only. Your character just starves to death every time. Hey again, it's back to just Amanda. My outro is going to be three parts. First, honorable mention of some other awesome games that came out this year. Second, a little bit of gratitude. And third, what to look forward to for next year. So like I said, first up, honorable mention. These are games that writers on our site either wrote about in their best of 2024 lists, or reviewed, or hyped up, or just loved in our Discord, where we chat and discuss and kind of manage all of our editorial stuff. But didn't get featured on the podcast. So I'm just going to read these out alphabetically by name with like a little blurb about them so you get a sense of it. And if you want to read more, I encourage you to visit our site at punishedbacklog.com, where we post really good stuff and check out all of our best of 2024 features, or, you know, you can just type one of these games names into the search bar and see what comes up. All right, so without further ado, the alphabetical list of honorable mentions of great games of 2024. Ace Attorney Investigations, Miles Edgeworth Collection. It's a port of DS games, but one of which never made it to the West before, which I played and really enjoyed. You're a detective lawyer. It's awesome. Animal Well, a mysterious puzzle game that has like a very specific aesthetic. Bo, Path of the Teal Lotus, an ancient Chinese-inspired Metroidvania that Donovan reviewed on our site. Botany Manor, a plant management puzzle game. Call of Duty, Black Ops 6, pretty much exactly what you'd expect, but it does it well. College Football 25, which Mark on our site is a big fan of. Crow Country, a PS1 style kind of like blocky horror game, which Clint wrote about. Dragon's Dogma 2, a fantasy role-playing game that's kind of Skyrim-ish. Dungeons of Hinterberg, which we talked about more in depth on episode 10, but it's sort of like this dungeon crawler adventure story-driven game. Helldivers 2, a big multiplayer online action game. Like a Dragon, Infinite Wealth, which is another entry of the Yakuza series, which has a lot of, you know, fighting and drama. Lorelei and the Laser Eyes, another very aesthetically pleasing, exciting puzzle game. MLB The Show, which lets you play a woman in Major League Baseball for the first time ever, which is awesome. I didn't play it, but I love that they did that. I bought it and I just haven't played it. Mouthwashing, a first-person psychological horror adventure game of a shipwrecked crew on a space freighter. Everything I can tell is that it is a game that would scar me to my very core. Clint and Gary on our site both really like it. And I'll tell you this, when I looked at screenshots for a different our Punished Prop Rewards list, which you can check out from last week, where basically we give out awards on like fun random categories that Sam makes up. It's awesome. It's really fun. Like best genre, best NPC, best Mountain Dew and Doritos game, you know, like it's great. But when I try to pull together screenshots of mouthwashing for that list, I was so deeply disturbed, even though I Googled it for 1 second. So if that's the kind of thing you like, then check out mouthwashing. Nine Souls, another very stylish Metroidvania that Donovan reviewed. If you like Metroidvanias, you should just like search Donovan's name on our site. He does a great job covering that. Pal World, which we talked about in our Pokemon episode of the podcast, but it's like Pokemon with guns. Nintendo's very mad about it. Penny's Big Breakaway, which is a very colorful platformer game. Persona 3 Reload, which is like a remake of the popular Persona 3 games. Stellar Blade, a very sexy action video game with a lot of fighting by a very beautiful woman. Kay wrote a long piece about this on our site. Tactical Breach Wizards, which is a turn-based strategy fighting game where you play wizards in Kevlar. Tales of Kenzara Zhao, a Metroidvania set in Africa and inspired by stories from the lead's father. The Legend of Zelda Echoes of Wisdom, the first mainline game in the series where you actually get to play as Zelda herself. Super cool. And it's also directed by Tomomi Sano, who's the first woman to ever direct a game in that franchise, which is really cool. You play Zelda where she's got this sort of like magic wand and she kind of can clone and create different things in the game to kind of puzzle her way around and adventure and combat. Like she's creating echoes of things. It's cool. Sam on our site really liked it. The Plucky Squire, a platformer that goes between this like 2D story and then jumps into being a 3D. It's very cool. And then Warhammer 4000 Space Marine 2, a big hack and slash space fighting game. And last but certainly not least, there are two pretty big notable updates. The winner of the 2022 Game of Year at the Game Awards, Elden Ring, had its first and only so far DLC come out, Shadow of the Erdtree. It's basically like a whole nother game in the Elden Ring world. And then Stardew Valley got a huge update, in for free, which is crazy. It's 1.6 update, and that's now out on consoles as well. Allison wrote a great piece about, you know, all the most exciting things about the update on our site. So secondly, a little note of gratitude. Thank you so much to all the writers who joined me to talk about those games. I thanked them in some of the audio that ended up cutting out. So just in case you were like, wow, Amanda just asked all these people to talk about these games and then didn't thank them. I did thank them. But for your listening pleasure and to try to make this podcast not infinitely long, I ended up cutting a lot of the exit banter out because I do love a good exit banter. And speaking of which, you're about to get 10 minutes of exit banter from me. But I wanted to just thank everybody again. Thank you, Allison, who talked about Turnip Boy Robs a Bank. Thank you, David, for talking about UFO 50, Sam, Astrobot, Joe, Buckshot Roulette, Vaughn, Tekken 8, Zach, Bellatro, Kay with Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, Alexia with Core Keeper, Gary with Metaphor ReFantasio, and Ben, Prince of Persia, The Lost Crown. And thanks to me, I did it, you know, Snoop Dogg style. I just had myself on a list too that I talked about. Thank goodness you're here. But seriously, I've had a really fun time making this. Over the last couple of weeks, it was really fun to have several nights of these mini interviews. Thank you to everyone who makes all these awesome games. Thank you to everyone who's ever written at thepunishbacklog.com, and definitely everyone who's ever read anything. And thank you for listening to this podcast and this episode. This is actually about my 4-year anniversary with the site. My first piece came out on December 22nd, 2020, which was an op-ed about why I thought Cyberpunk 2077 was a bad game, even without all the bugs, and it's like epically bad launch. Since then, I've written dozens of pieces about little games, big games, games that made me cry, games that made me laugh. I became an editor a couple of years into it and edited even more pieces. I've worked on the podcast. I learned how to edit audio for this. I've interviewed some developers, which was really exciting. And I've just gotten to be a part of this super special community. The Punish Backlog crew brings me so much joy, and I love getting to talk about my favorite hobby with so many great people. I'm really grateful for the chance to write about gaming. One of my great passions is writing, and especially when I'm feeling uninspired about my fiction or a nonfiction piece I'm working on. One of the things that's really nice is then getting to exercise that muscle of writing, but about gaming, like this thing that I just love so much and that just brings me a lot of joy. So I especially want to thank my fellow editors, David Silbert and Sam Martinelli, who are not only great writers and editors, but really great people. Just such good dudes. I love working with you guys, and I'm so grateful for the chance to be on a team with you. So thanks for letting me be me. I'm so third. There's a lot to look forward to for next year. I'm personally excited about Assassin's Creed Shadows. It looks fun. I'm really excited to see more of Hades 2, which is in early access. And then there's also another game called South of Midnight that I'm really pumped about. We'll be talking about all these titles and more in an upcoming episode of the podcast when we do our Fantasy Gaming League update. So if you haven't listened to it before, the Fantasy Gaming is really fun, where it's our version of fantasy football, but where we draft video games and compare our teams based on their Metacritic scores. In that upcoming episode, we're going to review the 2024 final scores, announce the winner. I have a pretty good guess of who it's going to be. And we're also going to draft our picks for 2025 and just preview all of what's to come next year. So thank you for listening. Wishing you all a happy and safe holiday season and happy new year. And of course, happy gaming.